You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, today is going to be quite an eye-opener, I think. And I think you're going to enjoy it. Remember, I've been telling you for years that the Illuminati are attempting to pull off one of the biggest hoaxes of all time. They're trying to tell us that Jesus did not die on the cross, that he was married to Mary Magdalene, that they bore a child. That child was taken to the British Isles, where it grew up to found the Merovingian bloodline of kings, which became eventually the House of Stuart. And that in the coming New World Order, they will present a Messiah to the world who will ascend to the throne of the world. Of course, the real power will reside in a council of wise men behind the throne. And all nation states will cease to exist. There will be regional governments with parliaments, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, I've been telling you this for years. You've all been telling me that I'm crazy. And today, I'm going to give you verification from one of the highest members of what is known today as the Illuminati, Mr. Lawrence Gardner. And I think you're going to find today's broadcast quite illuminating, to say the least. Don't go away. I'll be right back after this short pause.
There's no reason for you to lose your mind, 'cause I've seen something that's gonna change our time. If I could, I'd make you understand. If I could, I'd make you understand. There's no hurry, it's gone.
Well, I've been trying for years, folks, and if I could, I certainly will, and I'm still trying. And I know that some of you are finally catching on, but many of you are still left in the dark, so to speak. Lawrence Gardner recently wrote a book called Bloodline of the Holy Grail, The Hidden Lineage of Jesus Revealed, with a foreword by Prince Michael of Albany. Lawrence Gardner is the prior of the Celtic Church's sacred kindred of St. Columba. He is an internationally known sovereign and chivalric genealogist. He's distinguished as the Chevalier Lebrun de Saint-Germain. He is President Attaché to the European Council of Princes, a constitutional advisory body established in 1946. He is formally attached to the Noble Household Guard of the Royal House of Stuart, founded at Saint-Germain-en-Laye in 1692. And listen to this very carefully. He is currently the Jacobite Historiographer Royal. Jacobite, ladies and gentlemen, is another word for Illuminati, which means that this man is in charge of the royal history for the Illuminati. And so what he says means something. And you're going to have to make up your own mind about exactly what it means. But basically what he is saying and what the Illuminati is trying to pull off on the world is that there is a secret bloodline that has been protected by the Knights Templars and by an organization called the Prairie de Sion and many others, and that this history is known to the secret societies, Freemasonry, and the Ancient Order of Rosicrucii, the Knights Templars, the Sovereign and Military Order, the Knights of Malta, and many others. And that this bloodline has, according to the established lineage of the Bible, the Holy Bible of Christianity, the divine right of rule over all of the people in the world. Because this lineage, they say, is descended directly from the house of David through Jesus, who they say did not die on the cross but married Mary Magdalene, who bore a child, or maybe several children, who were taken by Joseph of Arimathea to the British Isles, Scotland, Ireland, and of course Great Britain, where they founded the Merovingian line of kings, which eventually, through tables and many, many tables of genealogy — there are so many tables of genealogy in this book, and in many others that I have studied that also say the same thing — eventually established the house, the Royal House of Stuart, and that is the ultimate goal of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry and many other of the secret societies, is to reseat this bloodline, one of the descendants of this bloodline, upon the throne of the world as a Messiah. Now, I'm not trying to tell you to believe this, because I'm telling you it's a crock of crap, is what it is. It's been used over the centuries to establish the legitimacy of the Anglican Church and establish an alternative by the secret societies to the kings and queens that have traditionally ruled. And of course, their ultimate goal is to destroy Christianity and topple the Pope off his throne and create a one-world government that will really be ruled behind the scenes by what they call a benevolent dictatorship of a council of wise men, of course, which will not be visible to the public. But this Messiah will be placed out here to sort of look out after the public good. At least that's what the public is supposed to think that he's doing. But there's something wrong with this. I mean, it's really wrong. The whole thing is designed to bring down all segments and all churches and all of the believers of the Christian faith, because if Jesus Christ did not die on the cross, and if he did indeed marry Mary Magdalene and bear children, and of course if they can make everybody believe this, then Christianity is dead. It is no more. But the problem is this, is that they base everything that they say upon the Holy Bible, which we all know, if you prove any one part of it to be wrong, and if you prove that the New Testament is wrong and that Jesus Christ did not die on the cross, and I'm not telling you to believe that he did, this is not a religious broadcast, so don't get all up in arms if you don't believe in Christianity. What I'm trying to tell you is one of the ultimate goals of the secret societies is to destroy all religions, and no matter what religion you believe in, if it's not the humanist religion of the Illuminati, you're scheduled for extinction also. So you better listen to what I got to say. But the main target is Christianity, because Christianity has been their biggest enemy over the centuries. And their God, of course, as you have learned on this broadcast, is Lucifer. So if they prove that the New Testament is wrong, they've also destroyed the foundation of their claim to the throne of the world. You see, but most people don't understand that. It's all based upon the biblical line of the right to rule that was given to the house of David by God. And if all of that falls apart because somebody can prove that the Holy Bible is wrong, a lot of people already think they can, then their whole claim to the throne of the world is lost. It's gone. It's just so much BS, crapola. Just another lie. But that's what they're trying to tell us, and I'm going to give you a book report today on this book. I'm going to read a portion of it to you called The Sangreal Today. Sangreal, of course, means the Holy Grail, which they claim is the holy blood of the ancestral line or the genealogy of the house of David through Jesus. And this is chapter 20 in the book. It's called The Bloodline Conspiracy, The Sangreal Today. This was written by Lawrence Gardner. And the title of the book, in case you'd like to get a copy, and I hope you do and read it, so that you'll catch on to the baloney that's in here. This isn't the only one, folks. We're being flooded with books that pretend to prove that this is true. And pretty soon they'll come forward with someone who they will say is a direct descendant by blood of Jesus the Christ, who will then be placed upon the throne of the world. He will, in fact, be the Antichrist if you are a Christian and believe in the prophecy of the book of Revelation and also the book of Daniel. But this is called Bloodline of the Holy Grail, The Hidden Lineage of Jesus Revealed by Lawrence Gardner. There are many others. Holy Blood, Holy Grail by Lee, Bijant, and Lincoln. Also, Temple in the Grail by the same three, and The Messianic Legacy also by Lee, Bijant, and Lincoln. So, here we go. Listen carefully. And I'm quoting directly from this book. This is a book report. Hopefully, you will run out and buy it and read it use your brain to interpret what's really going on here. It's part of a monstrous plot. These days, it is generally understood that establishment history is largely based on recorded propaganda. It was originally compiled to suit the political needs of the era when written, rather than necessarily being an accurate record of events. In short, it is generally a slanted version of the truth. For example, the English historical version of the 1415 Battle of Agincourt understandably differs from that of the French viewpoint. Similarly, the Christian perception of the Crusades is not necessarily shared by the Muslims. There are at least two sides to most stories. In 1763, the journalist John Wilkes accused George III's government of misrepresenting facts in the King's speech. Today, such challenges are common enough. But Wilkes was seized and flung into the Tower of London. In those days, there was no freedom of speech or opinion. Yet, during that same period of constraint, a vast amount of government-approved history was produced. Gradually, over the years of the 20th century, the official registers of nobility have been revised to correct a multiplicity of errors in past editions. But many of the errors, some still not fully corrected, were not mistakes as such in the first place. They were purposeful misrepresentations. As a direct result of Hanoverian, that's Georgian and Victorian policy, for instance, it has long been claimed in Britain that the Stuart succession became extinct while in exile. British history books are pretty well unanimous in stating that Charles Edward Stuart had no wife at his death and no legitimate male offspring. But they are quite wrong, and the continental European records tell a very different story. According to doctrinal English opinion, the present heir to the royal house of Stuart is Prince Franz of Bavaria, who is said to inherit the Scottish honors by virtue of the last will and testament of Charles Edward's younger brother, Cardinal Henry de Jure, Duke of York. This will supposedly nominated Charles Emmanuel IV of Sardinia as the Stuart successor. By way of marriage in the female line of descent from Charles Emmanuel's brother, Victor Emmanuel I, the present Franz of Bavaria succeeds his father, the late Prince Albrecht, relying in this on a somewhat tenuous ancestry back to Henrietta, a daughter of Charles I. The fact is, however, that Cardinal Henry Stuart's will did not name Charles Emmanuel as his successor. This is a complete fantasy that has made its way into the history books. But it was originally a purposely contrived deception on the part of Georgian politicians, a deception perpetuated by the later Victorian ministers. From the time that the Elector of Hanover began his reign as King George I of Britain in 1714, it became politically expedient to suppress or veil a good deal of information about certain families while enhancing the lineage of others. The House of Stuart came under particular attack in order to justify the incoming German succession. Even today, history books repeat the nonsense contrived contemporarily and afterwards to discredit the Scots dynasty and its associated families. The fabrications are so well ingrained that they are destined to prevail for as long as historical authors continue to copy from one another. Charles Edward Stuart was married in 1772 to Princess Louise Maximilienne, the daughter of Gustavus, Prince de Stolberg-Gedern, in 1784. However, papal dispensation for divorce was obtained following Louise's affair with the Italian poet Vittorio, Count Alfieri. Louise had been declared barren by the doctors, and after a few years of marriage, she left Charles in 1780 to take up residence with her lover. The divorce is frequently described as the end of married life for Charles Edward, but it was not. The Stuart archives in Rome and Brussels reveal that in November of 1785, Charles was married again to the Comtesse de Mathelin at the Santi Apostoli in Rome. She was Marguerite Marie Therese Odia de Audebert de Lucan, a cousin by descent from Charles's granduncle, King Charles II. Until 1769, she had been a ward of her own granduncle, Louis Jacques de Audebert, Archbishop of Bordeaux. Marguerite's paternal grandmother, Teresa, Marquesa de Aberny, was the daughter of James de Rohano Stuardo, Prince of Bavaria, Marquis de Aberny. He was the natural son, legitimated in 1667, of King Charles II and Marguerite, Duchessa de Rohan. On her mother's side, Marguerite de Masselin was descended through the Comte de Lucan. In November of 1786, the 37-year-old Countess gave birth to a son, Edward Jacques Stuardo, or Edward James Stuart, who became known as Count Stuarton. Although no secret in Europe, news of Charles Edward's legitimate son and heir was immediately suppressed by the Hanoverian government at Westminster. He has consequently since been totally neglected by academic historians in Britain. In that same month, Charles Edward's daughter, Charlotte of Albany, born 1753 by Clementina Walkinshaw of Borrowfield, met King George III's brother, William, Duke of Gloucester, at the house of Prince Santa Croce in Rome. Concerned about the strength of her own position as Charles Edward's legitimate offspring, she informed Gloucester of the royal birth and sought his advice. The Duke confided that Charlotte's status was probably safe enough, but his main concern was a letter that had been sent to her father by King George III in 1784. This letter suggested that Charles Edward could return to Britain from exile as the Count of Albany, that's Scotland. Charles had declined the invitation, but the matter was now complicated by the newborn son, who might well choose otherwise on becoming the second count in due course. When Charles Edward died, a contrived substitution of wills enabled knowledge of both the marriage and the birth to be concealed from the British public, a concealment that was perpetuated through the Hanover Saxe-Coburg era until the truth finally emerged in the 1970s, they claim. In 1784, Charles had made a will nominating his brother, Cardinal Henry de Jure, Duke of York, as his royal heir. Charlotte of Albany was to be the sole estate beneficiary. This is well enough documented in the historical biographies, but what those accounts fail to mention is that this was not Charles's final testament. It was superseded by another before his death. Not only was the fact of this later will concealed by the Georgian Parliament, but so too was the reason for its existence. In order to stabilize King George III's position, his politicians thought it expedient to end the problem of Stuart popularity in Britain by having the Scottish line declared extinct, particularly since the Jacobites had been so instrumental in the American War of Independence from 1775 to 1783, verification of what I've been telling you for years, folks. An enormous number of deprived Scots had immigrated to America following the subjugation of the Highlands after Culloden. They had not managed to regain their independence at home, but continued their cause from across the Atlantic, thereby aiding their fellow Americans to secure their own freedom from Hanoverian constraint. On 30 January 1788, the de jure King Charles III, fondly remembered as Bonnie Prince Charlie, died, aged 67, at the Muti Palazzo in Rome. Shortly before his death, he wrote his last will and testament. This was witnessed on 13 January 1788 by the Dominican Father O'Kelly and the Abbey Consalvi, both of whom were executors. The will stated that Charles's offspring, Edward James and Charlotte, were to be co-heirs of the estate. His son Edward was to succeed to the royal honors on his 16th birthday, and Cardinal Henry was to be temporary regent in the meantime. Now, following Charles Edward's demise, his ambitious brother Henry wasted no time in proclaiming himself King Henry I, or King Henry I, de jure of Scots, that would be the ninth of England, and to support this claim, he produced not Charles's will of 1788, but his earlier will of 1784, which suited Britain's government, since the cardinal was not likely to have any children. Both O'Kelly and Consalvi were party to the intrigue in return for rapid promotion within the church, and soon afterwards the former became Dominican procurator, while the abbey was raised to the cardinalate. Now, Charlotte of Albany was provided with a home in Frascati, and the Muti Palazzo was retained for Marguerite de Massillon and Prince Edward. Also involved in the scheme was the Abbey James Placid Waters, procurator of the Benedictines in Rome. Now, by declaring himself King de jure, Henry sought to nullify the immediate regency clause in his brother's will, but in January 1789, Henry made his own will, in which he redressed his selfish strategy for the future. All his possessions and heritable status were bequeathed to Prince Edward James, that is, quote, to my nephew, Count Stuarton, end quote. Both Cardinal Ercole Consalvi and Cardinal Angelo Cesarini were privy to the will and were executors, as attested in their memoirs. As it happened, Henry subsequently lost a great deal of his wealth in the French Revolution and during the Napoleonic advance into the Papal States. In 1799, he became a pensioner of the British Crown at the rate of £5,000 per annum, which is about $250,000 in today's terms. But in return, he was required to rewrite his will. At a joint meeting between Prince Edward, Comtesse Marguerite, and the Pope, a suitable rewording was agreed. The new will was made in 1802, but the inheritance still rested with Prince Edward. The revised document simply substituted the words, quote, to my nephew Count Stuarton, end quote, with, quote, in favor of that prince to whom it descends by virtue of de jure blood relationship, end quote. When Henry Stuart died in July 1807, King George and the British Parliament decided that the second will was actually less appropriate than the former. They therefore ignored the 1802 document and reverted to Henry's original will of 1789, and the press reported that Henry had made his bequest to his relation, Count Stuarton, meaning, of course, Edward James. However, no one in England thought to inquire who this relation, Count Stuarton, might be. Having dealt with the first hurdle, the Hanoverian ministers then produced Henry's amended 1802 will. By virtue of its malleable nature, the wording, that is, in favor of that prince to whom it descends by virtue of de jure blood relationship, was strategically implemented in favor of Charles Emmanuel IV, ex-king of Sardinia. He had recently abdicated to join the Jesuit order, and so the Stuart legacy passed to a potentially childless monk. Charles Emmanuel duly wrote to King George's Parliament denouncing the nomination because he knew the Stuarts to be alive and well. Indeed, having lived with him in Sardinia from 1797, Marguerite and her son Edward were then resident at his house by the Corso in Rome. The correspondence was ignored at Westminster, and the whole issue was put under wraps in Britain. History now records the diverted succession as having progressed from Sardinia through Modena into Bavaria. The reality is that the legitimate royal house of Stuart exists today and has long been actively interested in European constitutional management. In 1809, a dispute over sovereign loyalties arose between two sons of George III. It became known as the War of the Brothers. Prince Edward, Duke of Kent, the father of Queen Victoria, was a Freemason, while his brother, Prince Augustus Frederick, Duke of Sussex, was a Knight Templar. Edward's problem was that his brother's Templar colleagues were Stuart supporters. He therefore endeavored to sway their allegiance to the reigning House of Hanover. In the event, he failed, but compromised by creating a Templar-styled branch within the existing Masonic structure. This fell under the protectorate of Kent and followed the English York Rite of Freemasonry. The chivalric Templars pursued the Scottish Rite under the protectorate of Prince Edward James Stuart, 2nd Count of Albany. There he verifies years of research that I have given you over this broadcast. I continue. While the exiled Stuarts were in France and Italy, they were deeply involved with the general growth and dissemination of Freemasonry, and they were the instigators of the exported Scottish Rite, which had higher degrees and held more profound mysteries than other Masonic systems. Prominent in this movement was Charles Edward's cousin and mentor, the Comte de Saint-Germain. The Stuarts' involvement was firmly based on established rights and privileges, with a desire to initiate brethren into the true antiquity and pedigree of the craft. In England, in England, the inherent secrecy of the club-like lodges provided the perfect facility for undercover intrigue against the Whigs in the German succession. Throughout the land, the Jacobite societies and Tory lodges became closely entwined, as a result of which they became prime targets for Whig intelligence, whose high-ranking Secret Service operatives duly infiltrated the fraternities. In later years, English Freemasonry dispensed with political intrigue to become more concerned with allegorical representation in the codes of brotherly love, faith, and charity. And if you believe that, you're not playing with a full deck of cards. That's what they want you to believe. That's what he wants you to believe. But it's not true. He continues, in Europe, however, many scientifically based intellectual lodges of the traditional style are still extant. In 1817, a Dr. Robert Watson purchased in Rome some of Cardinal Henry's documents concerning the Stuart dynasty. He paid £23, equivalent to about £610 today, which is probably around $1,200 U.S. dollars, and prepared to publish the contents. But before he had a chance to do this, the files were seized by the papal police and passed to London, so that their contents would not become known. Sometime later, the doctor received a payment from Westminster for having been deprived of his property. Not content with this, Watson pursued his right to the papers, only to be found dead, supposedly having committed suicide in 1838. The papers have never since appeared in the public domain. Along with Cardinal Henry, the Abbey Waters also lost his possessions and became a pensioner of King George. Waters, an executor for Charlotte of Albany, was the custodian of various other Stuart papers. His guardianship, of which constituted the route to his future Hanoverian income, and in 1805 the Abbey was obliged to pass them over to the British government. At length, some were deposited at Windsor Castle, where they remain today. As for the rest, their whereabouts are conveniently unknown. And, folks, if I had to make a bet, remember the fire they had at Windsor Castle? Remember that fire? If I had to make a bet, I'd bet those papers were all burned. Anything that would legitimize the claim to the throne by the House of Stuart was most probably destroyed in that fire. By virtue of these documentary acquisitions, the way was deemed clear for Prince Edward James to be totally excluded from historical records in Britain. But this was not the case in continental Europe, where he is well documented in papers held by the Stuart trustees and features in the writings of René, Vicomte Chateaubriand, Abbey James Waters, Princess Caroline Murat, and others. Although the Stuarts have been ignored by the British authorities since the death of Cardinal Henry, the descendants of Prince Edward James, Count Stuarton, 2nd Count of Albany, have been actively engaged in social, political, military, and sovereign affairs for the past two centuries. They have often advised governments on constitutional and diplomatic matters in an effort to promote the ideals of public service and religious toleration as upheld by their own reigning house, and they have been particularly concerned with matters of trade, welfare, and education. In 1888, Prince Edward's grandson, Charles Benedict James Stuart, 4th Count of Albany, was scheduled to visit Britain. He was due to attend a grand Stuart exhibition at the New Gallery, London. It was sponsored by the Order of the White Rose, and the main organizers were Bertram, Earl of Ashburnham, and Melville Massieu, Marquis de Ruvigny, but the exhibition was wholly undermined by Hanoverian agents, and Prince Charles Benedict, guess what, was found dead, presumed murdered, in Italy. There was no display in 1888 after all. A rather different exhibition was held the following year. Instead of being in honor of the Stuarts as was planned, it was promoted to celebrate the bicentenary of the Whig Revolution, which had deposed James VII, which would be the second, and the Stuarts in 1688. The exhibition's new patron was Queen Victoria herself, and the event was used as a cover to obtain even more valuable documents of Stuart heritage. Having been ousted from their patronage, Lord Ashburnham and the Marquis de Ruvigny directed their future interests towards the chivalric societies of Europe, the Order of the Realm of Sion, the Knights Protectors of the Sacred Sepulchre, and the Order of the Sangreal. The governor of Oklahoma, ladies and gentlemen, who was the governor at the time of the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, is a member of the Knights Protectors of the Sacred Sepulchre. And, you know, you might want to pursue some of that. Who knows? Don't go away. I'll be right back after I rest my throat for a second, get a little drink of water, and we'll continue. Continue with this, folks. We're not going to finish this today. We'll finish it, wrap it up tomorrow. It's just one very small chapter. It's 12 pages toward the end of the book. And we're doing it as a book report to encourage you to go buy this book and read it. It's extremely interesting, and it will give you a real big clue as to what the Illuminati wants you to believe and what will be coming, you know, within a few years on the world scene. And believe me, it will be coming, folks. You've got to understand that somehow. In spite of Queen Victoria's efforts to suppress Stuart popularity, there was a significant Jacobite revival in the late 1800s. The Queen's advisors therefore sought to emphasize her tenuous claim to Stuart descent to the exclusion of the Stuarts' own Scottish heritage. As a result, Thane Banco and the Scots line from King Alpin disappeared from the Hanoverians' readjusted Stuart registers. The Lord Lion, King of Arms, subsequently wrote, "The traditional account of the descent of the family from Banco, Thane of Lochaber, and through him from the ancient kings of Scotland, is now generally discredited. From that time, the Stuart's Breton line was brought wholly to the fore. But why anyone should have to discredit one line of a descent in order to promote another is beyond ordinary understanding. Everyone has at least two lines of immediate descent, and the Stuarts, of course, were no exception." Subsequent members of the Scots royal family were prominent in the Belgian resistance during World War II. Hubert Pirlot, Prime Minister of Belgium, was a close friend of the Stuarts, who had reverted to the original spelling of their name in 1892. In that year, they had moved to the Chateau du Moulin in the Belgian Ardennes, where they lived until 1968. This castle had originally been given to the family in 1692 by King Louis XIV. As recently as 1982, the city of Brussels honored the Stuarts with a grand reception. Then, on 14 December 1990, the Brussels registers signed, sealed, and authenticated an updated charter of the Royal House of Stuart, detailing the complete family descent from the time of Robert the Bruce down to date. Today there are several lines descended from Prince Edward James, 2nd Count of Albany. They include the Counts of Durnelly and the Dukes of Coldingham. Foremost, however, in the main line of legitimate descent from Charles Edward Stuart and his son Edward James is the present 7th Count of Albany, Prince Michael James Alexander Stuart, Duke d'Aquitaine, Comte de Blois, head of the Sacred Kindred of St. Columba, Knight Grand Commander of the Order of the Temple of Jerusalem, Patron Grand Officer of the International Society of Commissioned Officers for the Commonwealth, and President of the European Council of Princes. Prince Michael's own compelling book, Scotland, The Forgotten Kingdom, a thoroughly detailed and politically corrected history of the Scots royal descent, is now in the course of preparation. Of course it is. This senior Stuart descent goes all the way back to King Arthur's father, King Aidan of Scots, on the one hand, and to Prince Nacien of the Septimanian Midi on the other. The Scots descent traces further back through King Lucius of Siluria to Bran the Blessed and Joseph of Arimathea, St. James the Just, while the Midi succession stems from the Merovingians' male ancestral line through the Fisher Kings to Jesus and Mary Magdalene. See, what did I tell you? And I told you this was going to happen years ago before this guy ever dreamed of writing this book. I told you that this was going to happen. I told you that they would make this case. And I told you, folks. And it's all on tape. All of it. I hate to be right. I really do. I hate to be right so much. And it's not because I have a crystal ball or I'm psychic or I can see this. Because I study. I study and I study and I study and I study. I study history. I study what's happening today. And, if you do that, you can't help but come to the right conclusions. Because nothing is really hidden. It's all there for anybody who wants to dig for it. So most people are just too lazy to do it. Let me continue. We might get through this today. I don't know. Maybe. No, I don't think so. We'll have to finish tomorrow. But anyway, let me continue. Conjoining the lines from their first century points of departure, the descent is in the succession of the royal house of Judah. This is a truly unique line of sovereign lineage from King David in one of the key descents which comprise the bloodline of the Holy Grail. Now, let me tell you what's really behind this, ladies and gentlemen. Behind this, and you better listen to me carefully, is pure Zionism. The concept that there is a divine race chosen by God to rule over all other races and all other people in the world, and that this divine right to rule was given to David, and that his descendants which they now call British Israelism, our Christian identity, and the radical sect of Judaism, Messianic Judaism, are all combined to claim that the Anglo-Aryan race is the real true Israel and is destined to rule the world. And in case you belong to the Mormon Church and you think this applies to you, it doesn't, folks, because it's not going to be in Missouri or Illinois where this new Jerusalem is. It's going to be in the real Jerusalem, is where these people want it to be. And the wealth, the real power behind the throne, will be in the 1 mile square city of London, known as the British Crown. Got that, guys? The 1 mile square city of London is not subject to the rule of the Queen. It is known as the Crown of England. It is a separate sovereignty altogether, and it is a creation of Freemasonry. And there are more Freemasonic lodges in that 1 square mile of London, known as the Crown of England, than there is in all of the United States put together. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. And now we get to the role of America in all of this. The Crown of America. Beneath the streets of Rome, the catacombs of the pagan era hold the remains of more than 6 million Christians. Laid in a single row, the passages would extend for 550 miles, or 880 kilometers. Ironically, the later fanaticism of the Inquisitions accounted for more than 1 million additional lives because the victims were supposedly not Christian. Through the centuries, millions of Jews have been persecuted and killed as a result of anti-Semitism initiated by the early Christian church. This was managed mostly under cover of the accusation of deicide. It ran completely out of control during the Holocaust of the early 1940s. But anti-Semitism still lingers. Tens of millions of Soviet Russian lives were lost during Stalin's brutal dictatorship, an autocratic totalitarianism that despised religion in any form. The Soviet Union was a Masonic state, ladies and gentlemen, and they always will despise religion in any form. In fact, their goal is to completely abolish all religions save their secular humanist religion. Vast numbers such as these are beyond the bounds of practical imagination, but their memory cannot be confined to savage regimes of the past. Worldwide religious feuds continue, just as in the days of old, and the ethnic cleansing of the Inquisition is still apparent today, and the place where it's most apparent, or places I should say, are most probably what is known as Bosnia and Ireland. In theory, communism was introduced to fulfill a socialist ambition, but the dream soon died as the giant machine rose to power by military oppression. Capitalism, on the other hand, is equally ruthless because it venerates balance sheets above the welfare of people. As a result, millions are condemned to starve to death in the poorer regions, while vast food mountains stockpile elsewhere. And folks, lest you think he was pinging on communism, socialism, he's not. They are communists and socialists. And this idea that capitalism results in millions of people starving to death in poorer regions while vast food mountains stockpile elsewhere is a socialist, communist idea. And it's not true at all. Even in the United States, he says, where the Constitution promotes the ideal of liberty and equality, we see an ever-widening gap between the privileged and subordinate groups. Rich communities are now barricading themselves within walled environments, while the welfare systems of the West are crumbling into bankruptcy. History has proved many times over that absolute rule by monarchs or dictators is a road to social disparity. Yet the democratic alternative of elected government has often proved similarly inequitable. Even elected parliaments can become egotistic and dictatorial in a world where those entrusted to serve may regard themselves instead as the masters. Now listen very carefully, because he's laying the foundation for the world to accept a Messiah king of the bloodline that he has documented in this book. Pay very close attention. Additionally, in countries such as Britain that have a multi-party political structure, the people are regularly faced with the rule of ministers empowered by a minority vote. In such circumstances, who is there to champion the rights of individuals? Trade unions, some might say. But quite apart from being politically biased in themselves, such organizations are still subject to government control. Although they may have a weight of membership, they have no final authority to equal that of Parliament. As far as the judicial system is concerned, its purpose is to uphold legal justice, not moral justice. Others in Britain may cite the Queen as the people's guardian, but Britain has a parliamentary monarchy in which the sovereign reigns only by consent of Westminster. Given the lack of any written constitution, British monarchs are quite powerless to champion individual rights and liberties to any effect. The present heir to the throne has genuinely sought to bypass the restrictions by speaking out from time to time, only to suffer recriminations from the establishment. Like a Victorian child, he is supposed to be seen and not heard, while bankers and industrialists control the fate of the nation. So often one hears politicians quoting the British Constitution as if it actually exists by way of a documentary privilege, but it does not. It is simply an accumulation of old customs and precedents concerning parliamentary sanctions, together with a number of specific laws defining certain aspects. Since Scotland's 1320 Declaration of Arbroath was nullified by England's Treaty of Union in 1707, the oldest written constitution now in force is that of the United States of America. It was adopted in 1787, ratified in 1788, and effected in 1789. In that same year began the French Revolution, which abolished feudalism and absolute monarchy in France, thereby influencing politics in much of Europe. Remember, I told you that the Founding Fathers established the United States of America in order to set the common man free, make him a king in his own right, so that it would topple the kings and queens off of the thrones of Europe. And that's exactly what it did, and that's exactly what he acknowledges right here. And that's the truth of it. That's what it was supposed to do, and that's exactly what it did. He continues, in close to 200 years since the Revolution, France and other European states, with Britain as a noticeable exception, have adopted written constitutions to protect the rights and liberties of individuals. But who champions these constitutions on behalf of the people? I do, folks. You all know that. But there really isn't too many others, you know, other people like me. We have no power. He continues, a popular alternative to absolute monarchy or dictatorship has been found in republicanism. The Republic of the United States was created primarily to free the emergent nation from the despotism of Britain's House of Hanover. Yet its citizens tend still to be fascinated by the concept of monarchy. We got the close there, folks. We'll continue this tomorrow. Now remember, all that I've been telling you right now is leading up to his justification of putting a king upon the throne of the world to protect the rights of individuals around the world and champion the Constitution of the New World Order, which in effect is the United Nations Charter and doesn't guarantee any rights for anybody. Good night, folks, and God bless each and every single one of you. Thank you.
In the spring.